Welcome, everybody, to episode 180 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. This is one of our very semi-regular appearances of our Unsolved Mystery episode. I don't think we've done one since, I believe when I checked, it was October 21st. Barry, did you happen to know what occurs on October 21st, my man?
October 21st is 4 days before my birthday. That's what
it is. No. I want to talk about a really important date, not your birthday, really important date. What do you think that would be?
October 21st is the first pizza was invented in the U.S. in New York.
No, pizza is important, but this is really important. I'll give you a hint, Barry. It's a really important birthday of someone who may or may not be affiliated with the show.
It's Sweet Lou Kippelman's birthday.
It is not. It is my fucking birthday. Thank you.
There you go.
So we have not done an Unsolved Mystery since, Barry, it's been like 6 months almost since we've done an Unsolved Mysteries. So we are back for yet another Unsolved Mysteries episode. Today, we are going to be looking, amongst others, at the murder of Barbara Colby, actress. We're going to be looking at the Alphabet murders. We're going to be looking at the unsolved murder of Daisy Wick. We are going to be looking at the murder of Rebecca Young. We are going to be looking at the murder of Kim Raffo, and we're going to start, Barry, with the disappearance of a man named Peter Bergman. I'm going to get to that story in a second. Before we get to that story, which occurred in Ireland, I would like to give a Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry shout out to Gareth Cross. Why am I doing that? Because Gareth posted for the first time in our group, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, recently. And Gareth is in Belfast, Ireland. And I thought to myself, Barry, how cool is it that we have people from Belfast listening to this fine, fine podcast?
It's amazing. And it's amazing when you stop and you think, and it's almost cliche at this point, you know, when you talk about the whole worldwide aspect, but the fact that the show drops Eastern Standard Time roughly around 9 a.m. on a Tuesday, and within 24 hours, a guy in Belfast, or, you know, maybe one of our listeners in Japan, which we have several, Wales, of all places.
Wales is one of our favorite countries.
Love Wales. So yes, it's pretty, it really is. It's an amazing, amazing world that we live in. And I could be no more proud to be associated with such a fine Peabody award-winning podcast.
Yes. And I would also like to mention, as I posted last night, our group is growing at a fairly amazing rate, Barry. We have added somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 85 new members to our Facebook group within less than a month. Okay. And the fact that we've done so means that people do not, here we go, Barry. They do not want to just stick to wrestling.
Oh,
so, got the McAdam reference out of the way. So anyway, Barry, let's talk. Oh, and I want to mention, I'm sorry, before we start, that we have added our good friend Mark Hertweck as a moderator in our group. Welcome aboard, Mark, for the fabulous sum of $0. And I know you're very happy about that. Okay, let's get to our first story. Barry, are you ready to go?
I am ready to rock and roll, Jeff. So bring on this story. Coming all the way from Ireland, is that what you said?
That's what I said. The first story involves the strange appearance and then death of a man named Peter Bergman. Let me give you a little background on this, Barry. So there's a town in Ireland, in the northwest part of Ireland, called, I believe it's pronounced Sligo, S-L-I-G-O. And in June of 2009, a man arrived in Sligo. He checks into the Sligo City Hotel, and he signs in using the guest name Peter Bergman. Now, why do I put it that way? He ends up giving an address in Vienna, Austria, that, according to police, is a vacant lot. So he stays there for approximately 4 days, and each day he's seen leaving the hotel carrying a purple bag that appears to be relatively full with items. He comes back to the hotel each day, and the bag is noted to be emptied. Okay. He also makes a point, seemingly, of avoiding different closed circuit cameras that are throughout the town. I believe one of the hotel guests or clerks noted that he had what appeared to be a German accent. So after a few days, he has a cab driver drive him to a remote beach where he's picked up a few hours later. He said he wanted to find a nice beach where he could have a swim that day or another day. The last day, he's seen purchasing a number of stamps And based on what they said, the amount of the stamp of each stamp was, it was not an item that could be mailed within Ireland. It was an amount that indicated that whatever mail he was sending out was going to be somewhere in Europe. Sort of like, you know, you might pay different for a first class package as opposed to sending something book rate like that. So anyway, he's observed on camera with a closed circuit in a restaurant, having a nice cappuccino and a sandwich. He's looking at a small piece of paper. Some speculated that it might be a to-do list. And then he tears up the paper, and then he leaves for the beach, okay? The next morning, a young man who I believe is training for a triathlon or something, he's with his dad, they find the body of Peter Bergman washed up on the beach. And the police do a 5-month investigation, and it comes readily apparent that this was a man that did not want his identity known. And the reason I say that is whatever they find of him, like as far as apparel, clothing, anything like that, all the tags have been removed very deliberately. So that led some to believe that perhaps he had, you know, been doing work as an intelligence agent or, you know, in the police force or some kind of government job where he did not want his identity known. Now, the autopsy, when they did it, Barry, showed that there were no, quote, classic signs of drowning. But they didn't necessarily think it was a homicide either. It was almost as if this man had come to the town of Sligo to die. And so what happens is they do the autopsy on him. They find that he has advanced prostate cancer with bone tumors all throughout his body, but yet he's taking zero pain medicine. So they said this guy must have been in a tremendous amount of pain for the advanced stage of cancer that he had. I could tell you about that. And the fact that he had all the different tumors and the fact that he had, you know, no pain medicine, like not even like an aspirin, Barry, much less anything stronger in his system was a very strange thing. Now, he ends up being buried. The only people that come to his funeral are 4 police officers. So there is literally, this happened in 2009, no one has come forward to say, I know who this guy is. This guy was a relative. This guy's a friend of mine. I worked with him. None of that. But this happened in 2009. So in 2015, a French newspaper does an investigation on this story, and they reach out to the Austrian authorities because, of course, he gave a Vienna, Austria address. The Austrian officials said that no one from the police department in Ireland had ever reached out to them and said, hey, we've got this guy who lists an address in Austria. Can you possibly check it? So there'd been no follow-up by the Irish police. I don't know what happened there, but quite weird. So Barry, we have a guy who basically showed up. No one knows who he is. He dies under, I'm not going to say suspicious, like murder circumstances, but odd. It was just odd. And he's buried in an unknown grave. And so the mystery continues to this day, some 12 years later. Who was the guy that said he was Peter Bergman? And why did he come to this small town in Ireland to die and have no one know about it? Very odd.
Well, very odd, too. So first question that it would run through my head, too, is as you're telling this story is, Have they dug the body up to do DNA testing to try to determine who he is? Because I don't know. It sounds like certain things are missing from this, and the fact that the Irish police never contacted Germany, Austria, or even Switzerland, where they speak German, very odd that they wouldn't have tried to do some DNA testing, get a sample, and then reach out to the police departments of those countries. To try to figure out, you know, who this guy possibly is. Very odd. And yeah, what about the stamps? Stamp thing?
No. I'm just going to address the first thing you said. I will say that the investigation between the day he was found dead and when he was actually buried, it went like 5 months. So they didn't bury the guy the next day. So I'm sure, do I know that they did DNA research or checked on his DNA? No, I don't. But I can't imagine after 5 months that something along those lines wouldn't have been considered.
But to that point, Jeff, if they haven't reached out to the police departments of Austria.
That's very fair. Very fair.
Like, yeah. You know, we expect, are these guys working for the LA? The LA, you know, right? That's like what they do in Los Angeles. It's all these fucking holes falling through. That's terrible.
Yeah. But so, yeah, and there's a real interesting video that's out there about this guy, how he just seemingly kind of came in from nowhere and left. And it's just a very bizarre story of the man, you know, it's like the proverbial man with no name. And, you know, where did he come up with the name Peter Bergman? Is it a name he pulled out of a phone book or something? You know, that's part of the mystery, is the name itself. There were, because they couldn't find anyone with that name. I can't imagine there's not someone out there named Peter Bergman, for God's sake. But they said this was not him. So yeah, so I will post a link to the story. If I get a chance, I'll also post the video about the disappearances as you see the man. And one of the reasons that things I didn't mention, one of the reasons they thought that he may have had a career in the intelligence or government work is that even though he is captured on closed circuit cameras in the city on a few occasions, there's also other points where, like when he's discarding the items that are in the dreaded purple bag, those are never caught on camera. So this was a guy who knew where the cameras were located, and he made a point of getting rid of whatever was in the bag. They never have anything on camera with him disposing of items in the bag. And, you know, who knows? It might have been clothing. You know, it might have been personal effects. But whatever was in those bags, each day that he left the hotel, they never actually captured him on camera, you know, standing by a garbage can, throwing out a bunch of clothes or something like that. So this guy knew where all the cameras were located in the city, too, which indicates he might have perhaps had a career in law enforcement, might have had a career in intelligence or government work. So, yeah, just another thing to add to the mystery, Barry.
Yeah, and so in a couple of points with that too, Peter Bergman, it sounds familiar. Like I think there may be an actor, might have been a TV actor or something like that. The guy's not, you know, hugely famous, but the name sounds familiar. So who knows? May have gotten it from there. But the other thing, as far as the, you know, he has bone tumors, which I've never had a bone tumor, but I have heard they're horrifically painful. So this guy's not taking any pain medicine whatsoever. No,
and as a matter of fact, one of the cameras in the hotel that captured him, there's a clip where he steps out of the hotel and he's smoking a cigarette. The guy's dying of prostate cancer. He has bone tumors all throughout his body, but he's still sparking up old Smokey. You
know? Yeah. Well, I get that actually. You know what? Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. So. You gotta, you know, if you know you're dying, fucking go for it at that point. Yeah. But
so, so that's the mystery of Peter Bergman. Barry, why don't you tell us about your first interesting case?
Absolutely. It's a woman named Daisy Zick, and this is the Daisy Zick murder case.
I may have said Daisy Wick. I do apologize. It's Daisy Zick.
Yeah, you did say Daisy Wick, but I know the last time I corrected you on air, my pay was garnished, and I wasn't going to let that happen.
Don't you even think about bringing that up.
No, you come on. It's only, you know, yeah, you saw my check for E-Trade, Jeff. You know, I every penny counts now.
Solid $0.
Exactly. I owe you money is the way it is these days, that things are so bad. But this is the Daisy Zick murder. And it's an interesting story. It was January 14th, 1963. Jeff, quickly, how old were you January 14th, 1963?
I would have been a solid 1.5 years old. And I'm going to take a shot in the dark here and say that my parents, along with my brother and sister, we may have still been in Japan.
Yes,
I was born while my dad was stationed over in Japan in Yokosuka, or as the Japanese pronounce it, Yokosuka. So I had not come back to the United States yet, Barry.
Yep, you're cleared then, Jeff. You
okay.
are
okay. Wasn't me.
Good. No, but it was a brutally cold morning in Battle Creek, Michigan that morning, and things were about to get a lot worse for Daisy Zick. Daisy Zick was 43 years old. She had worked at Kellogg's, which I believe is what Battle Creek is known for. She had worked at Kellogg's for several years, and as any day, she woke up, she spoke to her husband on the phone and some other friends, and then she was going to go meet another friend for coffee before going to work at Kellogg's. So around 10 a.m., according to witnesses and her neighbor, saw someone at the Zick porch mudroom door. That individual was likely allowed in by Daisy and was also likely her murderer. The physical evidence allowed investigators to recreate much of what had happened in the tiny ranch house that morning. Daisy confronted her attacker in the kitchen area, and at some point, she tried to use the phone, likely to call for help, but not easy, because you got to remember in those days, Jeff, there was no 911, so she's probably dialing several numbers. But her attacker severed the phone line with the knife, which was believed to be the murder weapon, and it was believed to be a spoilage knife from Kellogg's. So the thought process there was the killer picked up the knife in Daisy's house but did not enter the house with the weapon. And that may be important later on as this story progresses. At some point, Daisy fled to the bedroom and was struck about the head. Her assailant went into her closet, got a sash from one of her robes, and then tied her hands. The killer then stabbed her several times on her bed, but Daisy struggled, was able to get off the bed, and ran to the spare bedroom. Her murderer began to stab her viciously throughout her torso. Based on the stab wounds, her killer sat astride on top of the body and brutally stabbed her multiple times. The murderer then dumped out her purse and took the little cash she had and her car keys, then drove off with Daisy's 1959 white Pontiac Bonneville. The killer then abandoned the car on one of Calhoun County's busiest roads, Michigan Avenue. To make this more interesting, the murderer was actually seen by several people driving the car and walking along the road after dropping the car off. Because of the temperatures, Jeff, and this is why it was important, because this was, again, the middle of January, the killer was completely bundled up from head to toe, making the perp, I know you love when I use the word perp, unavailable or unable to be ID'd. To complicate this even more so, because again, when a woman is killed in her home and it appears to be a crime of passion, she wasn't just stabbed to the point of death. She was stabbed to the point of somebody was really fucking pissed off. The first suspect is always the husband. However, little known fact about Daisy at the time, she was having several affairs with multiple partners. It was determined through interviews that one of the calls she had made the morning of her murder was to a man with whom she was also having an affair. So the thinking was it may have been a jilted lover or possibly.
What is going on at Kellogg's back then? Holy crud.
Especially back in those days. Yeah. But theory was it could have been a jilted lover, possibly an angry wife, girlfriend, who knows. This was the initial focus of the investigation, and many people at Kellogg's were interviewed and even polygraphed. The killer did leave evidence, though, Jeff. Fibers from his or her gloves and a single fingerprint, which may or may not have been left by them in the car. This was not a random killing. Whoever did it overkilled Daisy, which pointed to them having to a connection with her. Her husband, Floyd Zick, was cleared both by alibi and polygraph, so thus he was cleared as being a suspect. This story, though, became part of Battle Creek lore. It was one of these stories that apparently people were really focused on the brutality of the crime because they had not seen crimes like this with such a brutal aspect in years. But then the rumors of the affairs, because by all accounts, Daisy was a woman about town. We don't want to besmirch her reputation.
Some
58 years later or whatever it's been now. But at the same time, apparently Daisy was out catting around.
I believe that's the first time we have used the term catting around here on Breaking Cafe with Bob and Barry.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Continue with your tales of catting around.
All right. But having crawled through police files, witnesses did come forward that saw her killer. And by all accounts, it was a male that was in her car. However,
I don't mean to interrupt you.
Please.
But as I have questions here, one of the things you mentioned was that because it was so cold and, you know, the dead of winter and the person was all covered up. So were they not covered up to the extent where people obviously couldn't say, oh, that's a guy or that's a woman?
Well, it was. And I think initially, as police were investigating this, they kept their options open because there were, you know, a lot of wives or girlfriends that their mate was cheating with Daisy. But at the same time, a lot of witnesses that actually came forward said it was definitely a male and was so bundled up. You got a scarf over the face. Big, big, bulky jacket, a hat, everything. It was impossible to ID who was actually underneath that, but everybody was clearly pointing to the fact that this was a male.
Okay.
However, the main investigators believe that Daisy was murdered by a man named William Newman Daly. And guess who he was, Jeff? He was Daisy's postman.
Postman always rings twice.
Oh, Jamie Ward, very unhappy right now. Listening to this is, I'm getting texted, Jeff. He can tell I'm getting texted. Don't you dare besmirch the postal department.
Jamie Ward and Newman are both very upset right now.
Newman. Anyways, his description of the Zick garage door the morning of the murder was inconsistent with the evidence. He was known to have commented as to seeing Daisy nude previously to other postal workers. So that's interesting. He also had a
Was William delivering the mail, as they say?
Oh, well, he may have been. But it sounds like, according to the investigators, and I got to say, this is a really unique case in that there was a book written on this case by a guy, I believe, who lives in Battle Creek. He was on a podcast, and that's the only information you'll ever find on this. If you do a Google search, there's really not a whole lot out here. They all say exactly the same thing. But I was able to, you know, to manipulate to get a couple chapters of this book. So I was able to get, I guess, a little more information than what's technically online. But this
after
guy,
the show, after the show's over, I'm going to ask you exactly what you did to manipulate. A couple of chapters.
Yeah, absolutely. It
sounds like something that involved you not paying for something.
Well, you can apply that to almost everything. Well, that I do. Yeah, so let's be honest. If I can get away with not paying for something at this stage, especially, I'm all about that. But this guy, William Newman Daly, which interesting, you did say Newman. His middle name was Newman. There's something to that. He had a very violent temper, and he claimed to have seen a man walking on Michigan Avenue near the Chuck Wagon restaurant bar, which was around the time that Daisy's car was abandoned. But he then changed his story to say that it was a woman. He also had a rather unique hairstyle, which matched to one eyewitness who saw the man driving Daisy's car, leaving her street after the murder. Sadly, I have no idea what this rather unique hairstyle was, because that's something I did try to find out. Daly also owned a coat that matched the eyewitness who saw someone at Daisy's door that day. However, Mr. Newman Daly stopped wearing the coat after the murder. That's almost something right there. What was truly missing was here was the motive for Daly. There was no motive, essentially, that they could find or pinpoint. While not necessary in a murder case in Michigan, motive certainly helps the juries understand why a crime happened. Perhaps Daly had an affair with Daisy. He had commented to friends and coworkers that he'd seen her nude, but never mentioned about actually having sexual relations with her. He may have been a stalker that had been spurned by her. We simply don't know. And Daly himself passed away several years ago. Until his death, though, he refused to ever take a polygraph test.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. One of the things I think that makes this case really unique and compelling is that it happened during the daytime hours, and there were eyewitnesses. The killer would have had to have been dropped off or walked to the crime scene. In either way, he or she would have been seen. There was just no way. So, you know, it didn't make sense. The killer abandoned the car, which was Daisy's car, in a busy highway. So someone had to have given this person a ride, or his or her vehicle was nearby. This person would have had blood on their clothing and gloves, as well as should have attracted some attention of someone. But think about it. Who could be more invisible in this situation in any neighborhood than a postman, Jeff?
That's why I'm implicating Jamie Ward. I'm flat out saying it. You know, he would have been maybe one, but you know,
I don't think he was even born yet, to be honest. You know. Yeah, I think he was, but I'd be curious too. I know that we have a few listeners in the lovely, brutally cold state of Michigan. I believe Brandon New, who was a day one listener of our podcast. I believe he lives in Michigan. So I'd be curious if anybody of our Michigan listeners have ever heard of this story before.
I'm going to go on a limb and say that when you eventually get to the time when you want to leave the hallowed state of Pennsylvania, you will not be moving to Battle Creek.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. That's a very interesting case. I, you know, based on what I've heard, the postman sure sounds like he's implicit some way between the postman being able to move around the neighborhood without really raising anyone's suspicions. But again, as you say, you know, if he's got, you know, my postman comes to the door and he's got blood all over his uniform. It's going to make you go, hey, what's going on here, pal? You know,
but stop and think about that for a minute, too. And this goes back to the old, which was my, it must be because I always reference it. The Tank Morgan, or as Sweet Lou called him, Toadstool Tank.
Yes.
The Tank Morgan mystery, where, and again, a lot of that we were speculating based off of things that we had heard. But if Tank Morgan had truly been a hitman going from wrestling territory to territory, what a great cover. And when I told Bob Roop that story about Tank, he was like, is that cool if I steal this? Because I want to write about this. I think this is, he was going to do something fictionalized of a guy who's a professional wrestler that's also a hitman or an assassin. And I was like thinking, it's a great idea. But go back to the 1960s and, you know, who better to be a serial killer in a lot of ways than a postman? The guy is in and out of neighborhoods. A lot of times these routes may change. To try to track a lot of this shit is going to be really difficult. A serial killer that was a postman that was a serial killer, could have gotten a lot of traction.
Well, and you know, not to besmirch the memory of the dead here, but if this is a woman who, dare I say, had a reputation for catting around, perhaps the neighbors were used to seeing different men in and around the house. And so, look, Daisy's got another man coming by our house there, Marge. And, you know, it's like not going to be, wow, this is very out of character for Daisy. And again, we don't mean to besmirch her, but the evidence that you picked up, that's what they said about her, you know?
Yeah, and I think you do have to look at it, you know, as you know, because my God, you're in the court system for 8,000 years. You do have to look at every angle with something like that. So that, and that also raises a point too, is that was, and I don't know this, you know, I don't know the answer to this, but was Floyd Zick aware that his wife was having these multiple affairs, that men may have been coming in and out of his house? You know, because odds are the neighbors probably were, right? The neighbors, as you just said, the neighbors probably were seeing this.
And at that time frame, you can't believe that one of the neighbors wouldn't have said, Floyd, there's something I got to tell you.
Unless Floyd's a cuckold, which makes this story even more interesting.
Well, that is definitely the first time we've used that term here.
There you go.
Now, we are breaking new ground. We have new listeners, new people in the group. You know, is this going to be the catting around or the cuckolding episode anyway?
Oh, yeah.
So, but yes, very interesting story. Barry will post a link to this story also in our group, so you folks can check it out for yourself. The philandering wife in the early 60s, that's kind of got a different spin to it. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. So, all right, next I'm going to talk about the case of Angela Young. Angela Young was a young woman who in April 1991 was murdered in a sugarcane field near Belglade, Florida. Belglade, Florida, unless you work in the sugarcane fields, Barry, it's not a fun place to visit.
I think we can safely say, Jeff, if I'm correct, this is twofold. Belglade 30 years ago, give or take, it was deemed one of the poorest cities in the entire country of the United States. Yeah. It also had one of the highest rates of AIDS of any city in the U.S. Belglade is a place that I think you just summed it up. Unless you're in the sugarcane industry, you're never going to go to Belglade.
No, and I think it's pretty safe to say that the majority of the population that lives in Belglade is in some way connected with the sugarcane industry, you know, whether it's working. And unfortunately, most of the people are probably working the fields. It's basically maybe a step above a migrant worker. You know, I mean, it's a very rough life. But anyway, back to the story. So Rebecca was found murdered. She was 21 years old. Sadly, her mother had been murdered like 9 years before then. So after the murder, about a week after she's murdered and the body's discovered, police get a phone call from a man whose name is Antonia Fonseca. Which, by the way, let me just throw in as a longtime baseball fan. When I first saw this, Barry, the first name I thought of was former Cubs relief pitcher Antonio Alfonseca. So I was like, wow, this has got a baseball connection. But it's not. It's Antonio Fonseca. They're not sure if that was his real name or not, who called and claimed to see her talking to two Hispanic men. Now, this is one thing I thought was interesting, Barry. He said one was Cuban and one was Mexican. And, you know, I, immediately I'm like, well, if you're at a distance and you look and you see two men, how are you so certain that they're from Mexico and Cuba as opposed to, you know, somewhere in Central America, somewhere in South America? It just seemed awful specific to me. Like maybe this guy knew more. And then it was like, well, maybe it was the accents that he overheard. And, you know, of course, because I think we may have even talked about it before, Spanish spoken by a Cuban person is different than Spanish spoken by a Mexican person, and different than Spanish spoken by someone who's from Spain. It's all kind of different variables, pretty much like the way that someone in America from the South has a different accent from someone who lives in like New York City. But anyway, I digress. So he sees her talking, he claims, to these two, let's just say Hispanic men, and they're driving a blue Ford Bronco. They were arguing, it was believed, over drugs in South Florida, Barry. Shocking, I know you say. Then she is killed. I can't imagine what visually standing there, and he claims to have seen it, this must have looked like. She's killed with a machete. Oh, that's probably not a good sight. So anyway, Fonseca waits a week, and he said the reason that he waited a week was that he feared for his own safety. He feared that the men that he had seen do this crime would find him and seek him out. But then he, as he started thinking about it over the course of the week, he realized he had witnessed a murder and had some sort of responsibility to call the police. The police find her partially decomp. I'm sorry, I messed up at the beginning. She was found by the police after this phone call. So the police find her partially decomposed body. They ID her through her fingerprints. They find out that her boyfriend, here we go, a shock, Barry, had some criminal ties. He was not listed as a suspect, you know, directly with the crime, but there was a belief that he may have been indirectly involved, that he may have ripped off some drug dealers, or maybe Rebecca on his behest may have ripped off the drug dealers, something along those lines, and she may have paid for it with her life. Then on the May 14th, a prostitute, a known prostitute, calls the police and claims that a man that she was with had claimed to have killed an African-American woman. And so the police go after him. They end up arresting him on a DUI charge. He seems to understand that they're going to talk to him about a murder. But then when the police start talking to him about the murder, he lawyers up, and the police get no other information, so they have to release him. The police have been trying ever since this murder to come up with who this guy Antonio Fonseca is, but they've had no luck. The guy basically, after the one phone call, disappeared. They've never had any luck finding him after that. He did mention when when he was talking with the police on the phone, he mentioned a guy named Ricardito, and that he said that the guy they arrested apparently is still considered a suspect, but without the testimony from this guy Antonio coming forward, they really don't have anything else they can do. And apparently the guy Antonio was calling from a payphone. So it wasn't like, he was calling from his house and the police could trace the call back to the house. So this poor woman, Rebecca Young, her murder now some 30 years later, still unsolved, Barry.
Wow. So, and that's really interesting too. And Belgrade, I got to say too, CWF actually ran Belgrade, Jeff, in the
60s. Way to tie wrestling into this story.
Always got to, some guys will stick to wrestling.
What?
The rest of this we'll just tie it in occasionally, but they did. They CWF ran some cards there in the 60s, and I believe in the early 70s, and then may have stopped. There may have been an occasional show, but it literally was one of the poorest cities in all of U.S. And a lot of the people who lived there were immigrants from other countries. So I know a lot of people that had migrated from Haiti. Belgrade is where they wound up, and then they wound up working in the fields. Just not a great place at all. So it is interesting, though. But I think, too, what you just said is that when you said drugs may be involved, I mean, we both know drugs and murder in South Florida during that era, hand in hand.
Shocking. Yes,
exactly. Shocking. No shock there. Very interesting. They'll never find the killer, too. And I think Belglade, much like the Everglades, became the dumping ground. You know, apparently, whenever you killed some, you know, this is what rumors. I don't know this to be fact, Jeff. Maybe you do. But you kill somebody, you drive out to the Everglades, you dump the body. That's it. There's no evidence. Nobody's ever seen or heard from again. It's over.
Yeah, it's you know, unfortunately, that whole time frame. I mean, not that things are pristine now, but that whole time frame, the mid to late 80s into the early 90s, that was a lot of there was a lot of problems in South Florida that that I lived through. And, you know, it was all I can say is if you ever watch the documentary, we've talked about this. We haven't mentioned it in a long time, Barry. The documentary that is available out there, Cocaine Cowboys, will tell you what it is like to have lived in South Florida at that time period. That's all I'm going to say. So, Barry, now let's go to your next story. We're going to talk about the Alphabet Murders.
We are. We're going to discuss the Alphabet Murders. And I got to tell you, this is, I think, one of the more fascinating cases that I have ever looked at. I don't know how this wasn't on my radar previously. I'm going to assume there were only three murders, and that might be why. But at the same time, this is such an unusual case. So it's the Alphabet Murders. They're also known as the Double Initial Murders. It's an unsolved series of child murders, which began between 1971 and 1973 in the Rochester, New York area. All three victims were girls, either age 10 or 11, and their first name had the same, their first name, the first letter of the first name was also the first letter of the second name. So very bizarre. But to make this even more bizarre, all of these girls were also dropped, the bodies were dropped off in a city that matched the letters of their first and last name. So, I mean, to
wow,
me,
that is, yeah, that
that's
is
like, you know, what the fuck? Like, that's, yeah, that's something that's, you know, and you'll get more about that too, but really interesting. Each victim, unfortunately, had been sexually assaulted, murdered by either manual or ligature strangulation, and then the body had been discarded. So, the first victim was a young lady named Carmen Colon. This was November 16th, 1971. 10-year-old Carmen Colon disappeared while returning home from an errand. According to eyewitnesses, Colon was observed entering a car parked close to the pharmacy she had just visited. It's sad. Approximately 50 minutes after Colon exited the pharmacy, scores, multiple motorists driving along Interstate 490 observed the child naked from the waist down, running from a reversing vehicle believed to be a dark-colored Ford Pinto hatchback.
Oh, yeah. Why would you not see, you know, why would you stop when you see a child running in terrified fear from a car backing up, trying to get her, you know,
She's nude from the waist down.
That's just crazy.
Yeah, it really is. Carmen is frantically waving her arms and shouting, trying to get somebody to stop. Of course, nobody does stop. And then at least one of these witnesses observed Colon being submissively led back to the vehicle by the abductor. This also raises the question that, you know, you're watching a girl nude from the waist down. She's 10 years old. She's being pulled back to the car. Somebody has witnessed this and told the cops. Nobody fucking writes down a license plate number. Nobody attempts to follow this vehicle. Like, you know, really? I mean, unbelievable. Very sad. 2 days later, two teenage boys discovered Carmen's partially nude body, not far from Interstate 490, close to the village of Churchville. This location was approximately 12 miles from where Colon had last been seen alive. So again, her name was Carmen Colon. She was found in the city of Churchville, which I believe is right, a suburb of Rochester. Just, you know, unbelievable. An autopsy revealed that, yes, in addition to having been raped, the child had suffered a fracture to his skull, one of her vertebrae, before she had been manually strangled to death. Furthermore, her body had been extensively scratched by fingernails. Both the murder of Colon and the fact that no one who had observed the child attempting to flee from her abductor alongside the interstate had attempted to offer her any help whatsoever generated intense public outrage.
As it should have.
You know. Although police interrogated several suspects in the months following Cologne's murder, unfortunately, all were cleared of involvement. The case is still open. So very sad story. You've got Carmen Cologne found in Churchville. Interesting, too, Jeff, that it was 12 miles away. So it is that somebody deliberately drove her there. Our next murder occurred 17 months later on April 2nd, 1973, when 11-year-old Wanda Owalkiewicz disappeared from the east side of Rochester while returning home from an errand. According to the owner of the delicatessen that she had just gone to visit, the child had purchased some groceries at approximately 5:15 before she had begun walking home alone along Conkey Avenue. She was then reported missing by her mother, Joyce, at 8 p.m. that night. Sadly, Wanda's fully clothed body was found by a police officer at 10:15 a.m. the following day, discarded at the base of a hillside along an access road to State Route 104 in Webster, New York. So Wanda Wallowitz in Webster. This was, Jeff, 7 miles from Rochester. So again, this person abducted her, took her a little far, 7 miles, you know, not right around the corner, and then dropped her off. The position of her body indicated that she had likely been thrown from a moving vehicle with her body rolling down the embankment. An autopsy revealed she had been sexually assaulted, then strangled from behind with a ligature, most likely a belt is what they concluded. Several defensive wounds indicated that Wanda had fought her murderer as well. In addition, her body had been redressed after death. The autopsy also revealed traces of semen and pubic hair upon the child's body. More interestingly, several strands of white cat fur were found upon her clothing, although the Walkowitz family did not own a pet with the fur of this color. Police inquiries produced an eyewitness who informed investigators that as Walkowitz had walked home from the deli on the evening of April 2nd, he had observed the child standing alongside the passenger door of a large brown vehicle talking with the driver. This eyewitness was unable to obtain a clear view of the occupant of the vehicle, although the location of the sighting was just 0.2 miles from the Walkowitz home. Another individual who contacted investigators following this said that she had observed a man forcing a red-haired girl matching Walkowitz's description into a light-colored Dodge Dart on Conkey Avenue between 5:30 and 6 p.m. on the evening of this disappearance. Police did find that extremely credible. Sadly, a third victim, Michelle Manza. You got double M, so you had double C's, double W's. Now you got double M's. Michelle Manza was murdered on the evening of November 26th, 1973, which is 7 months after the last murder. 11-year-old Michelle Manza was reported missing by her mother after she failed to return home from school. Subsequent investigations would determine that Manza was last seen by her classmates at approximately 3:20 p.m. walking alone to a shopping plaza located close to her school. Approximately 10 minutes later, a witness observed Manza sitting in the passenger seat of a beige or tan vehicle traveling at high speed on Ackerman Street before turning onto Webster Avenue. According to this witness, the child had been crying. On November 26th, a motorist observed a man standing by a large beige or tan vehicle with a flat tire parked alongside Route 350 in the town of Walworth. Holding a girl, he strongly believed to be Michelle Manza by her wrist. When this motorist who had stopped to offer assistance, the suspect deliberately grabbed the girl and pushed her behind his back, also obscuring the license plate of the car. He gave the passing motorist a menacing expression that the motorist was actually frightened and had to drive away. Very scary stuff, Jeff. Manza's fully clothed body was discovered 10:30 a.m. 2 days later on November 28th, lying face down in a ditch alongside a rural road in Macedon, approximately 15 miles from Rochester. So again, Michelle Manza found in Macedon, which is 15 miles from Rochester. Her autopsy revealed that in addition to receiving extensive blunt force trauma to her body, she had been raped, then strangled from behind with a ligature, possibly a thin rope. Again, numerous strands of white cat fur were discovered upon her clothing. Investigators were able to retrieve a partial palm print from her neck and then traces of semen upon her body and underwear. A forensic analysis of the semen samples determined she had been raped by one single individual. An analysis of the contents of her stomach, Jeff, revealed traces of a hamburger with onions, which had been consumed approximately 1 hour before her murder, giving credence to early reports of a girl matching Manza's description, having been seen in the company of a Caucasian man with dark hair, approximately 6 foot tall between the ages of 25 and 35, both at a fast food restaurant in the town of Penfield, alongside Route 350. So although investigators interrogated more than 800 potential suspects, let me ask you a question too. Does that seem a little gamed up on that one? Investigators interviewed 800 suspects. Does that seem legit to you?
That seems like an awful lot.
Okay. I've never heard of that kind of a number before. But apparently they did 800 suspects in relation to the Alphabet murders. No one has ever been charged with the crimes and the cases remain unsolved. However, each child hailed from a poor Catholic family, had few friends, and had recently experienced issues such as bullying or poor academic performance at her school. Investigators did not discount the possibility the murderer may have been employed by, or at the very least held knowledge of, the practices of a social service agency in the efforts to initiate contact with or gain the trust of each victim. The similarities between the three: all three victims were pre-adolescent females who had disappeared from Rochester in the early afternoon on days of light or heavy rain, and whose bodies were later discovered in a nearby town. The body of each girl had either been discovered partially clothed or fully clothed, close to an expressway at a location typically accessible by a victim, by a vehicle, and each victim had evidently been thrown from or carried from a car. Each child was also short in height. All three girls had been raped before being strangled. In addition, all three were known to be viewed as somewhat lonely outcasts amongst their peers. Furthermore, an analysis of the stomach contents of both Wolkowitz and Manza revealed that both girls had ingested food shortly before their death, even though their families and friends say they hadn't seen them eat anything. This is interesting to me. Both contemporary and current investigators have stated the possibility each victim had been selected due to the double initials of her name is extremely unlikely, as for an offender to pre-select his victims for this incidental reason would likely involve his stalking the victim over an extensive period of time, thus increasing the risk of being noticed. To me, I don't know, Jeff. You've got three, and this is, you've got three girls here with whose initials all match. I mean, how is that a coincidence? And I realize, yes, it could be a coincidence, but what are the odds?
Yeah, the whole social services angle is an interesting one, because somebody who had some sort of, and especially if they've come from very poor families, it certainly is a better angle than some guy searching the neighborhood for a little girl that has the same initials, first and last name. That's just kind of very random stuff. What I can't help wondering is, with all the advances they've made in modern technology and modern forensic, if they still could possibly, I realize it's been, almost 50 years ago, but if in the evidence lab, they still have traces, because they keep evidence for many, many years, but if they could go back and retest any of the DNA evidence, whether it's the semen, whether it's any other kind of, you know, fingerprints, maybe there was a hair sample or something like that. If they could test that and possibly come up with a new suspect or maybe reinforce the case against someone they had already suspected, you know?
Yeah. And we're going to get to the suspects in just a minute. And boy, are they an interesting group. So they've looked at that. They don't consider the double initials as being something that, you know, somebody would have looked at. However, I don't know. However, the murder of Carmen Colon, who was the first victim, strongly indicates that her murder may have been committed by an individual that she knew or was possibly related to, unlike the other two. So why don't we look at that? And who would this suspect be? Why? It would be Miguel Colon, who was her uncle, Uncle Miguel. He is considered by investigators to be a strong suspect in her murder. Miguel was the brother of Colon's father. However, following the separation of Colon's parents, he formed a quote unquote relationship with her mother and became known as Uncle Miguel. That should tell you a lot right there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So just,
yeah, you know, I don't mean to stop here, but
no, please.
Maybe this is completely off the wall. But you know what, as you were sitting there talking about that, you know what I remembered? And I realize this is based on a novel, a work of fiction. But it reminds me of the scene from Silence of the Lambs where they're investigating and they are talking about the very first person that was killed in that movie. And they said, what does someone that is a serial killer, what do they kill? They kill that which they see and that which they covet. That was a line from that movie. And as you sit there and think about it, you know, and you talk about this guy, Miguel, he's having a relationship with the mom, but do we know or wonder whether or not the person he was really coveting was, you know, Carmen, this person that he sees and covets. And then that led him down the road. So maybe the first one was someone that he saw and coveted, and that led him down the road to the other two girls.
Yeah, that's a really good point, too. And a couple of thoughts with what you were just saying. First off, Silence of the Lambs, in my opinion, is a movie that gets better every time I watch it. It's like I could never get sick of that movie. I just think it's fantastic. But do you remember the great movie Manhunter, which was really the precursor?
Oh, yeah.
Of Silence?
Absolutely.
So do you remember, and it was William Peterson, it was the actor, and he had taken a leave from the FBI and investigations because he was literally getting into the minds of serial killers. Is that truly the only way to catch a serial killer? To understand, to get into the mind, to understand their thinking? I like that. That's what, yeah, you were just kind of inferring here, is that by the same token, Miguel may have. But with that kind of rationale, you were thinking for a second like Miguel was. So it's interesting to me, you know.
That's not may not be good, you know.
Well, yeah, I hear you. It may not be good. But hey, we'll get back to the story. So just weeks to Colon's abduction and murder, her uncle is known to have purchased a car closely matching the vehicle seen by eyewitnesses reversing upon Interstate 490 in pursuit of the child. Investigators did conduct a search of this vehicle after Colon's murder, discovering the interior and exterior of the car had been extensively cleaned and the trunk had been washed with a strong cleaning solution. Check, right, Jeff?
Yeah, boy.
Yeah. Questioning of the dealership, which had recently sold the vehicle to Miguel Colon, revealed the trunk had not been washed with the detergent prior to the sale. Moreover, a doll belonging to the child was found in his car, but relatives did point out that she had frequently traveled in Miguel's vehicle and may have just left it on a previous trip. Furthermore, according to a friend, 2 days after the death of his niece, Miguel had informed him of his intention to leave the country as he had done something wrong in Rochester, and he immediately relocated from Rochester to Puerto Rico 4 days after the murder of his niece.
Mm.
All signs are pointing to Miguel. So investigators, you know, not being from Los Angeles, clearly thought, yes, there's something here. And they traveled to San Juan to question Miguel in March of 1972. Miguel surrendered to authorities, agreed to be extradited back to Rochester to face questioning. Miguel was unable to provide a credible alibi for his movements on the day of his niece's murder. No individual could be located to corroborate any claims he made regarding his whereabouts. And despite very strong circumstantial evidence attesting to his guilt, no physical evidence was located at the crime scene or within his vehicle to link him to the murder. They had to let him go, and he went back to Puerto Rico. Miguel Colon, though, did commit suicide in 1991 at the age of 44, following an incident of domestic violence in which he shot and wounded both his wife and his brother, which would have been the father of Carmen. So a very sad story.
I wonder what that domestic altercation was about, Bear. What do you think?
Yeah, a lot of shit going down right there, Jeff. Yeah. However, we do have another spec deck. This was Dennis Termini, 25-year-old Rochester firefighter named Dennis Termini. Dennis was a prolific serial offender known as the Garage Rapist.
Let me just say, you know, if they, the police give you a nickname like that, it's generally an indication you're not a good person, you know.
And that also raises the question, who gives out most of the nicknames? Is it the police or is it the media that actually does that? But yes, the Garage Rapist, not the nickname you want. He was known to have committed a minimum of 14 rapes of teenage girls and young women between 1971 and 1973. Also known to have owned a beige vehicle, similar in the description to the vehicle observed by several eyewitnesses to the abduction. Moreover, he is known to have lived at an address on Box Street, an address very close to the victim, Michelle Manza, who had just been seen alive. 5 weeks after the death of the final victim of the Alphabet murders, January 1st, 1974, Termini tried to abduct a young teenage girl at gunpoint. He fled the scene when the teenager refused to stop screaming. Shortly thereafter, he abducted another potential victim, although on this occasion he was pursued by police, culminating in Termini committing suicide by shooting himself in the head.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, exactly. A subsequent forensic examination of Termini's vehicle revealed traces, Jeff, of white cat fur on the upholstery. In January 2007, which is now many years later, Termini's body was exhumed to obtain a DNA sample, which is what they should have done for the guy in Ireland.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, for comparison with the semen samples recovered from Walkowitz's body. The results of the test confirmed that Termini was not responsible for her murder. However, no physical evidence retrieved from the bodies of Cologne or Menza exist for comparison with Termini's DNA. That's an interesting one. This one, Jeff, is a name that you're going to recognize. Mm-hmm. Kenneth Bianchi. Familiar with Kenneth?
Apparently, they've got quite, like you said, I don't know if we're going to go through 80.
We're going to go through all 800, and Brian Last is going to be up in arms at this 50-hour show. I've only got one more after this one. But Kenneth, does Kenneth Bianchi ring a bell to you?
Yes, of course, yes, with the Hillside Murders.
There you go. So, of course, if you know your serial killers, Kenneth Bianchi, along with his cousin Angelo Buono Jr., were the Hillside Strangler murders of 10 girls and young women between the ages of 12 and 28. However, serial killer Kenneth Bianchi was working as an ice cream vendor in Rochester at the time of these murders.
Coincidental,
right? Isn't that what we were talking about? He is known to
somebody that can move around a neighborhood much like a mailman could. Yes.
Right. Yep. He is known to have worked at locations close to the first two murder scenes. Bianchi was never charged with the Alphabet murders and is denied any culpability in the homicides. And he has repeatedly attempted to have investigators officially clear him of suspicion. So the guy is in jail for 10 murders. I believe he's got life, no possibility of parole, but he wants his name cleared on this case.
Yeah.
However, while residing in Rochester, he is known to have driven a vehicle of the same color and model as the vehicle seen near one of the abduction sites. However, the last name is the one that really stands out. Joseph Nasso. So in April 2011, Jeff, which is many years after these murders, a 77-year-old man named Joseph Nasso was arrested in Reno, Nevada. Reno, where I also believe Tank Morgan had been assassinated, if I'm correct. Was he in Reno or Vegas? I don't know. I just like bringing up Tank Morgan. For the murders of four women in California committed between 1977 and 1994, all are whom believed to have been prostitutes, and all of whose surname began with the same letter as that of their first name. My. What a coincidence, Jeff. Nasso was a New
Someone
York...
Someone say there are no such things as coincidences.
That's what they say. I don't know. This is right. This one is pretty interesting, though. Nasso was a New York native who had lived in Rochester during the first part of the 70s and was known to have regularly traveled between New York and California. He was initially described by authorities as a person of interest in the murders. DNA testing has confirmed Nasso's DNA is not a match to the semen samples recovered from Wanda Wallowitz. Nasso was brought on trial June 18, 2013, charged with the murder of four California Alphabet murder victims. He was unanimously convicted of each murder on August 20th. On November 22nd, 2013, Nasso was formally sentenced to death, where he awaits today on death row at the age of 87 years old. So interesting with this, too. The common theory with all this, and Jeff, I certainly want to get your thoughts on it, was that the first killing of Carmen Colon, she was killed by her uncle, Miguel Colon. The other two killings occurred by someone else.
That's the first thing I was thinking, too. This does not sound like the work of one person. It sounds like at least two, if not maybe three. And by the way, can I just say, apparently Rochester, not as attractive a city to live in as perhaps we might have thought. Holy crap, Barry. How many damn serial killers did they have that had connections with Rochester?
Which, and I was in Rochester once, and I got, have you ever eaten a Rochester White Hot, Jeff?
I have not.
It's fantastic. It's like a bratwurst, but it's there's no dye or food coloring, so it's white and it's spicy and it's fantastic. A Rochester White Hot, I love it. But Rochester is also really cold. So interesting to me that you've got guys like Kenneth Bianchi and Joseph Nasso going from Rochester, which probably one of the colder places in the U.S., and then going to California where it's not, you know, just interesting.
Rochester
to me,
probably at least as cold as Battle Creek, Michigan, I'll say.
This is the cold episode, the cold cuckold episode. Yes.
Yeah. So
the theory is, pardon me.
God bless you.
Get a little worked up. Absolutely. That Miguel Colon, responsible for the first murder, the next two murders done by the same person, in that, in, at least in, you know, and again, internet sleuthing is a very, as we learned with the Elisa Lam documentary of the Cecil Hotel, it's a very slippery slope that you want to be careful with because you could ruin people's lives. But with that being said, you know, I'm not really too concerned with Joseph Nasso or Kenneth Bianchi, as they both sit on death row, if I'm correct. So, the other two murders do look to be committed by the same person. I'm really intrigued by the fact that, again, take out Carmen Colon, that's fine, but that the other two murders occurred and the first and last name, same initial, dumped in a city of that same initial as well. I'm thinking that possibly they read newspaper accounts of Carmen Colon's murder and were so intrigued by that that to them, they had to do something similar, some sort of copycat killer is what I get. Joseph Nasso, you know, certainly doing the same type of serial killing in California is interesting, but there's no DNA evidence to point him to it. And even with Dennis Termini, there's no DNA evidence. However, that white cat fur is a matchup.
Yeah. And, so you know, the whole guys who do this, who when they're cornered committing suicide angle,
right?
That also makes me awful suspicious that perhaps the second two of the young girls were the victims of Dennis, and the first one was Uncle Miguel, very sadly to say. So, anything more to add, Barry, before we go to the next story?
No, just these are cold cases, Jeff. I will say Rochester police are actually still looking. At one point, they had something like 50 investigators on this case. Of course, currently it's down to one.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Barry, our next story is about a young lady named Kim Raffo. And, you know, Barry, when you start going down these unsolved mystery rabbit holes, that's how I discovered the story about Peter Bergman. That's how I discovered the story about Rebecca Young. And, you know, you're sitting there and you're trying to find an interesting case to look at. And as I was doing that the other day, it suddenly popped into my mind that I have a friend of mine named Maria, who used to be the dental tech for me down in South Florida. And we've known each other for over 20 years. And each year on the anniversary of her sister Kim's death, she posts a memory and says that her sister's killer has yet to be found. And so I reached out to her and I said, I would like to talk about this case if it's okay with you. And she said, sure. She goes, you know, more than anything, she wants, of course, her sister's killer to be, you know, discovered and found, which, of course, that's not breaking news. But she feels that her sister's memory has been tainted by some untruths, in her words, that were written about her sister. So we're going to talk about the life and the untimely death of Kim Raffo. Maria, I hope I do your sister's memory proud. Kim Raffo was born in 1971 in Brooklyn, New York, the Canarsie region of Brooklyn. Barry, are you familiar with that area?
I've never been there, but I know of it.
Okay. So her father, Robert, apparently had some drinking and drug issues that caused a lot of conflict within the family. The mom, Joan, and the sister, Maria. By the way, if you look at the link that I'm going to attach, it refers to her as Marie. Her name is not Marie. It's Maria. Go figure, a newspaper making an error, Barry. And so they moved to South Florida in 1988. And Kim follows shortly thereafter with her then boyfriend, Hugh Auslander. They move down there. Kim and Hugh get married. They have two kids, a little boy and a little girl. Seemingly, they have an idyllic life in suburbia. Kim emerges as really the strength and the pillar of the family. She even, Barry, gets her parents, who had since divorced. You know, again, I spoke about the father's issues with drinking and with drugs. And she's able to get her parents. Her mom, apparently, I believe, had remarried. But she gets her parents to the point where they sit down with each other at a family Thanksgiving or Christmas. And this is all due to the work that Kim put in to get her family to try to reconnect with one another. You know, that was very nice. And they were living a very suburban lifestyle. And then 2001 comes about and things change. In 2001, Kim enrolls in culinary classes at Sheridan Technical Center in Hollywood. Now, let me just say, and this is the only sarcastic thing I'll say about this case, Barry, because it involves my dear friend Maria. Hollywood, Florida is an area that I am well familiar with. I used to be an assistant manager at Toys R Us in Florida, and that's where I met my two ex-wives. So searching for spouses in Hollywood, Florida is not a good idea. I'm just going to say that. Okay. Now let's move on with the story. So she enrolls at Sheridan Technical Center. It is there when she's in Sheridan Technical Center that she meets a gentleman named Kenneth Bilecki, who, according to his own mother, is a chronic drug addict. Kim and Kenneth begin an affair. And her husband, Hugh, finds out about it. And there's an incident at a traffic light where he attacks Kenneth with a baseball bat, messes him up pretty good. Kim's family blames Kenneth for introducing her to crack cocaine. The husband, Hugh, files for divorce and moves with the kids to Ocean City, New Jersey. Before we started recording, Barry, you discussed that you know this area and that Ocean City, fairly close to Atlantic City, correct?
Yeah, 20, 25 minutes max.
Okay. So Kim goes up there to be near her children and live in Atlantic City. So while they go up there, there's another altercation, another fight between Hugh and Kenneth. The authorities get involved. The kids get temporarily put in foster care. Hugh ends up moving back to Florida. And Kim takes jobs waitressing, and her drug habit continues to worsen. And at some point there, I believe it was 2006, I apologize, I don't have a specific date. Kim is found in a ditch outside a club. There are allegations that she was working as a prostitute. Her sister Maria wants the wants it put out there that while her sister was in fact a drug addict, a person with a definite drug issue, a drug problem, that she in fact was not a prostitute. And it really outrages Maria that her sister is remembered as being some sort of a prostitute. You know, nobody wants to have a family member thought about that. And, you know, so anyway, so I reached out to her. Now what had happened was, this case, her sister is one of four women who were involved in a murder that had may have been a victim of a serial killer in the Atlantic City area. And, you know, apparently there were three other women that were found, generally speaking, in the same area as where Kim was found. Initially, there was some thought that she was a victim of someone known as the Eastbound Strangler, who was in that general area. But they since had decided that was not the case. So among the other women that were found, there was a woman named Molly Diltz. There was a woman named Tracy Roberts and Barbara Bridor. Kim was the last of the four women to that were found. And the amazing thing is there were people that were implicated in this case. The police, though, never found any more evidence than that. It's, you know, I think, unfortunately, the police, you know, while they're doing their due diligence, I don't want to say they're not, to the police, I'm just going to say it from their mindset. Oh, this is another drug addict that was found dead. You get what I'm coming from, Bear?
Yeah, absolutely.
And especially if in the belief of the police incorrectly that she was a prostitute, they may even have less to do with it. So maybe they weren't feeling more because, quite frankly, I'm going to say that the other women, the other three women whose names I mentioned, were in fact implicated as prostitutes. The bodies were all dumped. And so they've never solved these crimes and never gotten anywhere else with it. Okay, so Barry, all four of the women were found barefoot but otherwise clothed. They had been placed about 320 feet apart in a shallow water. With their bodies, for some reason, all their bodies were positioned facing east. That's why originally I mentioned that East Side case. That's what originally was the thought process of the police, that maybe that person was involved. But as authorities worked to determine who these women were they the victims of a serial killer? They all included a portrait in their lives of lives that had kind of started going downhill. That's one reason why. You know, when I was asking Barry before we started recording about the lifestyle of some people that go to Atlantic City, while I'm sure there are fine people that live there, there are also you know, much like we talked about Belgrade, how there is a history of drug abuse and other things that go on in Belgrade. Atlantic City seems to attract, Barry. You said I hate to say it, the drug addict.
Jeff.
Yeah,
it's seedy. It's not, you know, so here's the difference. When you walk Atlantic City at night, if you're walking anywhere off of the boardwalk, meaning you're walking either the streets or the side streets, it's dangerous. There's no two ways about it. Ocean City is actually really nice. It's primarily a seasonal tourist area. Everybody from Philadelphia and the tri-state area goes there for the beaches. Also, as a boardwalk, they have several amusement parks, water parks, a great beach. It's a lot of fun, but it's like night and day, Atlantic City and Ocean City.
So, Barry, as we're talking, I was just looking for a specific date for any of these murders. All four of the ladies were found in 2006. The murders were attributed to a person that they dubbed, you know, we were talking about the police coming up with names for the killers, the Atlantic City serial killer. He was also dubbed the Eastbound Strangler in the press, although I believe that was a different set of murders. In this case, the four women, all the remains were found behind the Golden Key Motel in New Jersey's Egg Harbor Township, and they were all found lying face down in runoff water and chemical waste, which, that's not a good way to go, Barry.
No, it's a sad story, too, and it's, you know, it's one of the things, too, that, you know, you get involved with drugs, and I've had people that I worked with. Unfortunately, Jeff, sometimes in the restaurant business, you know, there are people, because a lot of times it's a cash business, that people get heavily involved with drugs. And there was a similar story. It's not somebody that was killed, but somebody that was a good person that I knew for years. I worked with her actually in Fort Lauderdale, and she got addicted to heroin, and she was found dead one night from an overdose, but she was found on a street, face down in a gutter, you know, dead from drugs. So it's pretty sad. And, you know, what your friend, and first my condolences to your friend, Jeff, whether she's listening to us or not. It's a terrible story, just a terrible story.
Yeah. And, you know, this is one of these things I'd love to be able to say, well, this person did that. You know, they had people that they were, of course, investigating. They were investigating someone who had a history of crack usage. And I'm sure that person, you know, whether they were involved or not, I don't know. But, you know, you're right. And as you were telling the story about the person that you knew, I used to work with someone who I do not believe was involved in drugs herself, but she was, let's just say romantically involved with someone who may have been, and I'm going to say, a real small time dealer. This was not, you know, this was not, what do you call Al Pacino from Scarface. This was a very low level guy. But apparently he pissed off the wrong person, and he pissed off the wrong person. And that person came to see him while my friend that I worked with, was visiting him, and they found her dead and bound, in a closet. Where she had been shot, bound up, and they threw her in a fucking closet. And that mystery still remains unsolved. It's one of those things where they pretty much like, well, we kind of know this person did it. And I believe the individual that was the suspect is now in state prison for something else. But, you know, it's just one of those things. You know, there are so many mysteries where you kind of can say, I'm pretty sure I know who did this. But, you know, look, the cases we were talking about where we sit there and say, oh, it was the postal man in the one case. It was this person in the other case. And you kind of have a general idea. It was Uncle Miguel with Carmen Colon. That's who we suspect. But we don't know. And sadly, I don't know if my friend will ever get the peace of knowing specifically who it was that killed her sister. Will she have a good idea in her own mind? Yeah, I think it was this person. Perhaps, but you know, that sort of 100% check, you know, kind of thing. I don't know that she's ever going to have that sort of peace, Barry.
Yeah. And she may not. It's one of those things that's just, to me, it's horrific to even think about something like that.
Yeah. So now, Barry, why don't we go to your last story, which is of course the story of the actress Barbara Colby.
Yeah. Barbara Colby. And you know, Jeff, she was described as having a zest for life, with a heart as big as her smile, and her husky voice and toothsome smile attracted everyone to her immediately. Her career was on the rise, and she had finally gotten her big break. So why was she shot dead in a parking lot in Venice, California? Jeff, I wrote that myself, by the way. I wanted you to know that. So
that's very good.
That's pretty good, right? A few beers will do to you. Born in New York City, 1939, she spent a lot of time between New York City and New Orleans, where she spent a lot of her youth. She got her start in theater, eventually landing a part on Broadway in a show called The Devils in 1965. She married Bob Levitt. Bob Levitt, the son and singer of actress Ethel Merman. From all accounts, they had a happy marriage, practicing yoga together, as well as traveling the country in a van. So very metaphysical. She was very spiritual, you know, a good person overall. She also began a bi-coastal career in the early 70s. She was on a lot of different TV shows, a lot that I watch on either MeTV or GetTV, Jeff. Columbo, The Odd Couple, Gunsmoke, Kung Fu. The FBI, McMillan and Wife, Medical Center. Remember Medical Center, Jeff?
Yeah, Chad Everett?
Chad fucking Everett, man. Yeah. That guy.
That guy has some great hair.
Yeah, he did everything. There was not a flaw in his game. Chad Everett was the guy, but she was doing a lot of work on TV. She had a house in Malibu, as well as an apartment in New York City, Jeff, at the Dakota. And what is the Dakota known for?
That's where John Lennon met his ultimate demise.
That is it. That was about 5 or 6 years later after she met hers. She was continuing her Broadway and theater career, working in several plays and getting a lot of film and TV roles. She was in a few films called California Split, Memories of Us, and Rafferty and the Gold Dust Twins. Not sure that I've ever seen any of those movies. But however, in 1975, Barbara got her big break. She was playing a streetwise prostitute on two episodes of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. She was so well thought of by the cast and crew that Mary Tyler Moore then cast her in a spinoff TV series, Phyllis, starring the recently departed Cloris Leachman. She was cast as Julie, who was Phyllis's boss, and this was thought to have been the turning point in her career and really her biggest break thus far. Of course, as we know, you know, especially doing this type of show, things aren't going to go too well. On July 24th, 1975, Colby and a colleague named James Kiernan were walking to their car following an acting class in Venice, California, that Colby was a teacher at. Kiernan was a struggling actor, also had a role on Rhoda, another Mary Tyler Moore deal, which is interesting. As they approached the vehicle, both Colby and Kiernan were shot inside the parking lot. Colby was killed instantly, but Kiernan was able to describe the shooting to police before he died of his wounds. Kiernan said that he did not recognize the two men that shot them. The shooting had occurred without warning, reason, or provocation. Police noted that there was no attempt to rob the pair and concluded it was either a random targeted, it was either a random drive-by shooting or a targeted killing. Colby was cremated. Her ashes were then scattered into the Pacific Ocean in a ceremony off of Paradise Cove. Barbara was so well thought of by the cast and crew of Phyllis that Cloris Leachman actually filmed a tribute to her that was supposed to air before the upcoming episode of Phyllis. CBS, though, decided against airing the tribute, fearing that it would bring down the comedy aspect of the show. So network executives always there with a sympathetic move, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Sympathetic gesture. Yeah, absolutely. So, Jeff, who would have wanted to kill Barbara? Who would have done this? Six Utes believed involved in the shooting were arrested within days of the shooting. The police said they were suspects in another killing and four burglaries in the area. Investigators were sure they had the culprits, but witnesses placed them miles away at the time of the killing, and all six were released. Another theory that the killings were tied to a gang initiation. Unfortunately, that killing never went anywhere. And at the time of her death, it's always the spouse that they always look at. At the time of her death, Colby was separated from her husband, Bob Levitt, again, the son of Ethel Merman, but he was out of town, and he flew home once he heard the news. But to complicate this just a bit, even though she was married to Bob Levitt and he was separated, they were separated and out of town, Colby was living with the guy she was killed with, which was James Kiernan. So essentially, boyfriend and girlfriend walking out of an acting class and they're assassinated in the parking lot. Now, Bob Levitt couldn't have done it. He was in the San Francisco region. He had plenty of alibis and plenty of witnesses. However, do we think that Bob Levitt could have possibly in some form, hired someone to do this? So that was posed to several different people. And I should say as well, Barbara and Ethel Merman were extremely close. Ethel Merman is actually who identified the body quickly. While her husband, Bob Levitt, was still in San Francisco, still alive to this day, by the way. I believe he's 75, 76 years old. I did reach out to him for comment. He did not respond. Go figure. But she did have a close relationship with Ethel Merman. To complicate this just a little bit, too, the sister of Barbara Colby, her name is Renee. I did reach out to her. I did not get a response, but I was able to find quotes from her. She does not believe that Bob Levitt was responsible. She goes forth with this, that even though they were separated and she was living and having relations with another man, they were still bound by something spiritual, and he was happy for the success that she was having in her career. However, I was able to find quotes from friends and people that knew her that said there was always something about Bob that seemed off, that just made no sense. They don't say specifically that he was prone to jealous rages. However, he was known for trying to stifle Barbara's creativity. So take that for whatever it's worth. Here we are now, almost 46 years later. There has never been an arrest in the killings, and police are no longer pursuing this at all. The case is closed.
The thing that's odd when you say that, you know, people thought he was trying to stifle her career. You're talking about someone whose mom was Ethel freaking Merman, you know. Why would you, if you marry somebody who's in the industry, the entertainment industry, I'll just put it in group. Your mom's part of the entertainment industry. Why would you decide to stifle your wife if she's in that film? That comes off as kind of odd. The other thing I thought of right off the get-go was, you know, the supposition is that this was this attack, and let's just go under the assumption it's not a random attack, okay, that it was somebody was specifically targeted. You know, the belief is, it must have been Anne, but maybe it was James that was being targeted, not necessarily by, you know, the husband who was, you know, upset about that. Maybe there was somebody in James's life that was targeting them, and poor Anne just happened to be walking next to him when he was shot.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, there wasn't a lot giving when it comes to James. He was he wasn't a prolific actor. Actually, the only credit that I could find on IMDb was that episode of Rhoda. I do think that's a very interesting connection. I tried to see if there was a connection in their relationship that would have began on Mary Tyler Moore, whether he was, I don't know if they use the same soundstage or set or whatever. But I was trying to see if there was some sort of connection, if they would have met there. I don't believe they had been together for too long. The whole aspect that I get with the controlling, too, and if you look at it through different lenses, you can kind of see it. They were into yoga, but they were actually traveling the country in some sort of converted van or mobile home, but it was classified as a van, and they would actually go to different areas to meditate and do yoga. I found that very interesting. When she tried to get away, and I don't know if that's even the right verbiage, when she tried to, I guess, get back into her career as the acting career as opposed to the yoga, apparently this is where the controlling aspect, he didn't want that to happen. He had no problem with her being an actress, according to these sources. But at the same time, I think he wanted her to be a little more involved with the yoga and the time that they were spending together. So I will tell you, the sister Renee is an interesting young lady. She was running a Facebook group dedicated to her sister. And for years, I guess she wasn't aware that Barbara was her sister. I think she's a half sister also, I should say, but she wasn't aware that she was her sister. When she found out, I guess they had a very limited time together before Barbara was killed, but she credits Barbara as being the most influential person in her life. She truly loves and idolizes her. But I do find it interesting. She says nothing negative about her husband, Bob.
Hmm. So, okay, Barry, as we begin to wrap it up, that is the last story that we're going to talk about. Again, we will probably do one of these 4 or 5 months down the road. We try to do 2 to 3 per year. Always fun going down those YouTube and Google rabbit holes to find unsolved mysteries. It's funny, the first case I talked about, I was actually looking for another case when I stumbled upon that and was like, wow, this is kind of a really bizarre kind of story. The man who disappeared and didn't leave a trace of his true identity. You know, that's kind of weird. So anyway, I will remind you on behalf of Barry and our producer, the sweet man, Luke Hippelman, that Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Barry, we did forget one thing.
Oh, Jeff, we did forget something, Jeff. You're 100%, when I say we've, you're 100% when I say, right.
Yeah, that we forgot something. How correct would I be, Barry?
You're 100% correct.
Check. Okay, we got that out of the way. Whew, I didn't want to forget that. Yes. So let's see. We covered the McAdam reference. We did 100%. Okay, we're good to go. So until next week, we are back to our normal procedure. As a matter of fact, I can put this out there, Barry. Do you know what next week's going to be?
Yeah, there's nothing normal about anything we ever fucking do.
That's true.
Yeah.
Next week, Barry, it is Bull Nakano week, and we're going to look at one of her matches. Ooh, I'm going to put them out there. Good stuff. I was recently sporting the Bull Nakano shirt. Had a couple of, what the hell is that? So, Bull in all her fine regalia. So, and until next
incoming Georgia, Jeff, they don't get the bull knocking over.
They've never seen bull knocking over. On that note, we will see you next week, folks. Have a good one.